I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Pirates are part of our popular culture. Children dress up as pirates for Halloween. We see movies or visit theme parks based on the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. It's all part of our romanticized version of the rakishly handsome, swashbuckling sailor who plies the high seas in search of treasure. The real story of piracy, particularly the pirates, is much more complicated. Eric J. Dolan takes us on a deep dive into pirates and their history in his latest book, Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what sparked your interest in writing a book about pirates?
Well, I watched a lot of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, and I was very interested in pirates, didn't know a lot about them. But really what got me going on it were my kids. My kids were teenagers at the time, and I was trying to come up with an idea for my next book after my last one, Brilliant Beacons, about lighthouses. And I mentioned pirates to them, and both of them, their eyes lit up immediately, and they said, "That's it. You've got to write about pirates." And so that was an encouraging sign. That wasn't the only reason I wrote about pirates. Obviously, I had to get buy-in from my editor and publisher. But the fact that my kids were so excited about it, and also I have to sadly admit that I've written many books, but my kids have not read any of them, but they promised to read this one, and I know they will.
All right, so the founding of America and its early years as an independent nation is a story that we think we know, but your book looks closely at how pirates and piracy helped shape the colony, and so why do you think this story has remained so untold for so long? There's so many stories that I had certainly never heard of before.
I think part of it is because the romance of piracy and the time period that people focused on most closely was the 17-teens to 1720s, where the larger-than-life Blackbeard and those other pirates were operating along the American coast. But what people know very little about, and certainly what I knew nothing about before I started working on the book, was the great influence that pirates had on the colonies in the late 1600s. And that's actually the part of the book which I find most fascinating because it's most surprising. So I think it's just a matter of people focusing too intently on this very brief period of piracy, the Pirates of the Caribbean phase to a certain extent, and a few outsized characters, as opposed to understanding that piracy was a worldwide phenomenon, but it was a phenomenon that had great impacts on the colonies, their relationship with the mother country, and commerce in general.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a second, but I was interesting that a lot of the pirates that you talk about in the book are not names that are familiar. These are people we've never heard of before. So how did you discover them?
Well, there is an amazing amount of material in the records that colonial officials sent back to the mother country. I spent a little more than a week in London using their national archives, but also they have been so kind as to digitize the thousands, the hundreds of thousands of letters that colonial governors wrote back to the Board of Trade, Parliament, the Crown. And in those letters, they go on ad nauseum about everything that's happening in the colonies. And because piracy was such an intimate part of colonial life, a lot of those letters have huge passages on all these pirates that I've never heard of and probably nobody's ever heard of. And what they did and what they were doing is just fascinating.
Amazing, yeah. All right, so you begin the book with concerns of Philip III, King of Spain and Portugal, who was worried that England had an ulterior motive for the colony in Jamestown. So tell us about that. I had no idea how much, you know, wealth Spain and Portugal had.
Yeah, well, you have to go back a little bit towards the 1500s, and basically the Spanish conquered Central and South America. And what was in Central and South America? The Mayan and Incan cultures had been mining precious metals, silver and gold. And all of a sudden, Spain had controlled these vast deposits of precious metals that really made the world go round then and still do today to some extent. And they would send these enormous fleets of treasure ships back to Spain and over to the Philippines to trade. And the pirates are the ones who decided to attack those ships. So it was.
And so Philip is thinking, England and
Virginia.
Thinking, maybe this is going to be a base for pirates to get our ships.
Right. There already were plenty of pirates, such as Sir Francis Drake, who many people think is a privateer, but he really was operating as a pirate, who were attacking the Spanish. So when Virginia colony comes about, the king exactly what you said. He says, you know, this is a perfect launching port for piratical raids. And he actually sent a spy over to sort of keep an eye on the young Virginia colony to see what it was up to. And he was captured by the Virginians, but he managed to sneak a letter out to Philip that said, you better watch out. Mm-hmm. These people are going to use Virginia as a staging ground for raids on our ships. It ends up that their fears were overblown and Virginia was having a tough enough time surviving as a colony on its own, much less launching attacks on Spanish ships.
All right, you mentioned Sir Francis Drake. So, but before we get to, there was buccaneers. Before you talk about pirates and privateers, tell us what the buccaneers were.
Well, buccaneers are sort of pirates by another name. Those are the people in the Caribbean. They were the French, the Spanish, the Dutch, people that lived on Hispaniola, which is Dominican Republic and Haiti today. And they were there and they were raising hogs and cattle and they were minding their own business. But Spain thought that they owned everything in the West. So they ran these buccaneers. They weren't called buccaneers at the time. They ran these people off to Tortuga, which is right off Hispaniola. And that wasn't good enough. They attacked them. So the buccaneers, and the reason they were called buccaneers is because they used to cure meat in something called a boucan. So they were called buccaneers, and in English it became buccaneer. But these buccaneers who had been happy to mind their own business and sell meat to passing ships decided, okay, you the Spanish, you came after us, you killed many of us, we're going to turn around and we're going to prey on you. We're not going to just sell you meat, we're going to take over your merchant ships and your treasure ships if we can. And that's how the buccaneers got launched, and they were a prevalent source, a pain in the neck to Spain throughout the early 1600s and mid-1600s.
All right, so you mentioned Sir Francis Drake, and you say a lot of people thought he was a privateer, but he's really a pirate. So let's talk about the difference between privateer and pirate, because sometimes the privateers really were pirates.
Yes, it's a very thin line that separates pirates from privateers. Basically, privateers are individuals or ships and their captains and their crew that get something called a letter of marque from a government, from the crown or parliament, and it gives them permission during times of war to attack the ships of the enemy. It's a way of sort of amplifying the power of your navy. Pirates, on the other hand, don't have a letter of marque. They don't have any dispensation from any formal government power, and they often attack ships of any nationality. Now, many people have observed that there's a very thin line between the two, and in fact, people have often called privateering licensed piracy, which it was in some case. And many privateers got so used to attacking ships and basically looting them that they've sort of verged out of privateering into piracy, and it was almost a seamless transition.
There's a lot of money to be made in piracy.
A lot of money. Yeah. Well, think how huge the ocean is, and think about the money that's being transported and the goods. And if you are able to overpower another ship, there are plenty of places you can go to hide, inlets, bays, areas that are not colonized yet. So it gives people a very enticing object of opportunity.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting too, because you'd think, why would somebody want to sign on to a pirate ship? But they actually, the crew made some pretty good money there. You know, you'd think it would just be the captain and who owns the ship, but that was very enticing to join a pirate ship, because you, as just a crew member, could make quite a bit of money.
Right. These pirate ships were floating societies, and they developed a code, the Pirate's Code, or the Articles of Agreement. And one of them was the essentially equal and democratic distribution of the loot. Mm-hmm. Because think about it. You've got these bloodthirsty pirates who joined this enterprise to make money, and they wouldn't put up with some people getting a lot more than they got. So if you had a big score, if you took over a ship that had a lot of treasure, you could make a lot of money. But the flip side was, if you didn't have any big scores, nobody made money.
Yeah. All right. So tell us about Sir Francis Drake.
Well, Sir Francis Drake, Queen Elizabeth I sent Sir Francis Drake essentially out on an enterprise in the Pacific to attack Spanish galleons and bring the money back to England, because everybody outside of Spain, who was in Europe, was jealous of Spain's control of South America and Central America. And the reason he wasn't officially a privateer at that point is because England and Spain were nominally at peace. And when he came back, he was treated as a conquering hero because the amount of money that he brought back was essentially almost equal to the annual income of the crown. And he was, in fact, knighted for his efforts. Now, the Spaniards were incensed. Mm-hmm. They viewed Drake as a pirate. What you find out in the history of piracy is that if you follow the money, and depending on whose ox is gored, so to speak, you get very strange bedfellows. And that's mm-hmm. why I'm sure we're going to get into it. But the colonies welcomed pirates in the late 1600s because they were benefiting from pirates. But when pirates attack and you're not benefiting from them, then you want to get rid of them.
Yeah. All right. So there were colonists, many colonists, who supported the pirates, not only because of the money that they brought them, but the protection. Right. Because, we didn't have a navy at that point. So there was sort of twofold. It was boosting the economy, but it was also protecting.
Absolutely. In the late 1600s, you have to understand the relationship between the colonies and the mother country. The mother country viewed the colonies as a source of revenue, in effect, and they treated them in a rather poor manner oftentimes. And the colonists perceived this even 100 and some odd years before the American Revolution. So the pirates were essentially in the late 1600s, they weren't attacking English ships, which would have been a different story. They were going all the way to the Indian Ocean and attacking Mughal ships, ships from India that were going to the Red Sea, and they were bringing that money back home to the colonies. Many of these pirates came from the colonies. They were the fathers and sons and brothers of colonists. They were attacking, quote unquote, infidels halfway around the world who Westerners looked down upon anyway, and they were bringing their riches back to the colonies who were consistently starved of currency and goods by the mother country. So why wouldn't they be welcomed back? They knew these people. These people were helping the colonial economies survive and thrive, and they were filling a void that was left by the neglect of the mother country.
Yeah. And of course, by attacking these Mughal ships, you'd think, okay, what's the harm there, right? But then we've got the East India Trading Company.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that. And this had, an unintended consequence for them.
Yeah, to the colonists, attacking Mughal ships was a win-win situation. However, the British economy was supported to a great extent by its growing trading empire that stood on the shoulders of trade with India and the Far East, the East India Trading Company. So while on the one hand, English merchants in London were making a lot of money getting goods from India and the Mughal Empire, the colonists were stealing from the Mughal Empire. So when these pirates attacked Mughal ships, what did the emperor do, Aurangzeb? He complained to London. He said, "Your English pirates are attacking our ships, and we are going to shut down trade entirely with England unless you solve this problem." So that's what brought the colonists and the mother country into direct conflict over pirates.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they even went in and took the people working in the East India Trading Company, boarded it up at one point, and
After there's some particularly horrific attacks of very large Mughal ships that were partly owned by the emperor, they took the East India Trading Company's factories in India and turned them into prisons for nearly a year.
Mm. Because they weren't messing around.
They weren't messing around. They were holding them as ransom until they got proof from England they were going to take piracy seriously and they were going to clamp down on this threat.
All right. What does England do? We're going to find out. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan about his new book, Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Eric J. Dolan about his new book, Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. One pirate who has a very interesting story is Henry Avery. So tell us a little bit. I never heard of him before, but tell us a little bit about him.
Henry Avery, in about 1696, he was on a ship called the Charles II, and he was waiting to sort of be a privateer and go over to the Americas. But he and his men were not being paid. They were held at their port for many months without getting any pay, and their families back home were suffering. So they finally decided that they had enough, and they essentially mutinied. And Avery was considered a competent fellow at the time and had the confidence of his fellows. So they elected him captain. They knew about all these pirate attacks in the Indian Ocean, so they decided to go around the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean and attack some of these Mughal ships themselves, and they did. They attacked a few of them very viciously and got away with hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of treasure. There's one particular attack that was extremely nasty. It was a ship called the Gonzo Sawway or the Gunsway in English. And after they had overtaken this ship, which had more than 1,000 pilgrims going to Mecca with all of their money, after they took the loot, the crew began viciously attacking, killing, and in many instances raping the women on board. And some of them, rather than withstand this humiliation, especially in front of their friends and families, stabbed themselves or jumped over the side.
Yeah.
And so this attack on these very important Mughal ships got the Emperor Aurangzeb furious. He became furious and essentially shut down East Indian trade for the better part of a year. But Avery, he decided to get out of piracy.
Yeah.
And he
didn't push his luck. Yeah.
He didn't push his luck. And he ultimately made it back to Ireland and disappeared into the mists of history.
He was like the most wanted, right?
He was the most wanted. There was the first worldwide manhunt that was posted by the English government was to get Avery.
And they got some of his men, but not him.
They got some of his men, and they were going to put them on trial. They did put them on trial in London, and the hope was, on the part of the English government, is that by putting these men on trial, they would show Aurangzeb that they were serious about cracking down on pirates. But what happened? The first trial, the jury decided that all the pirates were innocent and let them off. And this caused a furor in London. They said, we have to do something to solve this problem. So they retried the pirates, but they couldn't try them for piracy again. So they tried them for mutiny, the original mutiny. And this time the jurors came through, found them guilty, and they were hung. But that only partially assuaged Aurangzeb's anger, because while some pirates had been hanged, Avery, the big fish, got away.
You know, and this attack really kind of highlights how barbaric some of these pirates were. They were a vicious bunch.
Pirates like to win through intimidation. They didn't want to fight. They didn't want to kill people, except for a few that were just totally sadistic. But if they were crossed, they would attack. And there are a number of cases, like the one with the Gunsway, where pirates did horrific things to people that had already surrendered. Mm-hmm. And that only added to their reputation as these international rogues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So successful pirates had to be good navigators, good sailors, good leaders. Give us an example, if you will, of a pirate who had those skills and a story of one who maybe didn't and that was his downfall.
Well, a pirate captain had to have the confidence of his men because the men voted on who would be the captain, and if he did a poor job, they could depose him. So one of the captains that obviously was a very good captain was Blackbeard, and he had a very successful run of pirating before he was ultimately taken down and murdered or killed by naval forces off Ocracoke Island. Another pirate who is a contemporary of Blackbeard's who didn't have either good captaining skills or navigating skills was Stede Bonnet. Stede Bonnet was called the Gentleman Pirate because he was the son of a sugar plantation owner in Barbados, and he inherited the plantation, and things were going along swimmingly for him, when all of a sudden he decided in around 1717 to become a pirate. And there's no real evidence as to why he made that decision. Some say he might have gone temporarily insane. Other people say he was having marital strife that caused him to abscond and become a pirate. But he did a very strange thing. He built his own pirate ship. He hired pirates as opposed to giving them a cut of the booty.
He gave him a salary, yeah.
Gave him a pay, went off. But it quickly became apparent that he didn't know what he was doing, and he had to rely on his men to navigate for him. They did have a few successes off the east coast of the colonies, but then on the way back, he encountered a Spanish warship, and a prudent pirate captain would have avoided a battle with such a powerful foe, but Stede Bonnet was not prudent at all, and he had gotten a little bit cocky because of their earlier successes and launched into battle with this Spanish ship and barely made it out alive. In fact, he was injured quite severely, and the ship just limped back to the Bahamas, Nassau in the Bahamas. And his career went on and on. We can go, if you want to go into that story, but he ultimately found his end at the end of a noose later on.
Yeah. Interesting, too, at one point when they're arrested, I thought it was interesting that he doesn't get thrown in jail like the other. He gets better because he's a gentleman.
Absolutely, yeah. He was an aristocrat to some extent. And so while the men on his ship, who were also caught at the same time, they were put in the jail, he was put in the marshal's house, basically nicer quarters. Now, they made a mistake. He either paid off the marshal or he was very good at escaping because he and one of his pirates escaped, but they were later caught and finally tried. But during the trial, a number of the upstanding citizens of Charleston, South Carolina, said, "We cannot hang this man." They begged for leniency because he was one of them. Mm-hmm. He was a gentleman. But that gambit didn't work, and he was ultimately hung like the rest.
Yeah. And there also was a certain amount of luck, right, being in the right place at the right time, having favorable weather. So luck played a role in all of this as well.
Absolutely.
All right, so pirates who were caught received a sentence of death. So was this typical punishment for thieves and robbers at the time?
Major crimes on land or at sea were often punishable by death. But the problem was, one of the things we talked about earlier, in the late 1600s, many colonists were sort of in favor of these pirates. So trials were hardly ever held. And even when they were held, the pirates often got off. It wasn't until the Parliament and the Crown decided that, no, you don't, you need to have more effective admiralty courts in the colonies. Mm-hmm. And we don't want fellow colonists, but we want government officials to stand in as the jury and the executioner, so to speak.
I'm thinking of Sneed. I can't remember his first name, but he really wanted to get the pirates off the streets, but he ran into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, Thomas Sneed. He was an official in Philadelphia. And some of Avery's men had escaped to Philadelphia, and there was this international warrant, basically, for their arrest. So Sneed went to Governor Markham of the colony, telling him that there were some of these pirates in their midst, and you needed to arrest them. Well, Governor Markham, like other governors in America, got kickbacks from pirates and sort of gave them fake privateering licenses for £100 a head. And he didn't want to do anything about these men in his midst because they had benefited him. But Sneed would not give up. And finally, Markham said, "Okay, I'll put a £5 bounty on their head." Well, Sneed knew exactly where they were. And he finally got them into jail, but they promptly escaped. And every effort that Sneed made to get Markham to take effective action only resulted in Markham turning around and attacking Sneed, stripping him of all of his guns, and he was being harassed by the pirates in the street. And the other problem was Sneed's daughter was married to one of Avery's men. So essentially, Sneed finally gave up. He could not overcome the
protection.
He could not overcome the malfeasance that was taking place in the government of Pennsylvania at the time.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. As we mentioned earlier, pirates have been romanticized in American culture. Talk about the influence of Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island on generating interest and creating this illusion of pirates in our culture.
Well, Robert Louis Stevenson's book, Treasure Island, first published in 1883, is the one that gives us that most famous image of a treasure map of Skeleton Island, in this case, with an X, actually three red crosses that mark the spot. And many of the pirates that are in this book are sort of almost good-natured bad guys. You know, they do steal. They occasionally kill. But, you know, that's just part of the job. And
pirates will be pirates.
Pirates will be pirates. And this is also the one that gives us that familiar sea shanty refrain, you know, 15 men on a dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum. But it wasn't just the book that romanticized things. It was the movies that came out later, many Treasure Island movies. And he was such a beautiful writer that he wove this great tale. I mean, in the end, the pirates were undone, but it's still along the way. There was something exciting. And I don't have a good answer for this. Why do people love to read books about murder? Mm-hmm. Why is that what we see on the news all the time? Bad news. There's either some kind of vicarious thrill that we get from reading about these bad boys and girls of history, or something else that just draws us in because it's so dramatic. But right. The reality of pirates was not romantic at all.
And what's interesting about the treasure map is we have this idea that pirates buried their treasure, and in fact, there's no evidence that they did.
No evidence. That's one of the greatest myths of all. Think about it. First of all, pirates like to spend their money. So why would you bury your treasure? Also, if you buried your treasure someplace, what's the guarantee that you're ever going to get back there to dig it up? And there might even be the possibility that somebody else would find it and dig it up in your stead. So they like to keep the treasure close to them at all times so they could make use of it whenever they needed to. And I mean, Captain Kidd is a classic example. People think that he buried his treasure all the way from Delaware up to Oak Island, Nova Scotia.
Nope.
there's no evidence, but people have spent probably, I would guess, over the last 6 or 7 decades at least, they spent certainly hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, looking for his treasure. And I guarantee it. They're never going to find it.
Never going to find it. That was a surprise. Captain Kidd really wasn't much of a pirate at all, was he?
No. Well, he originally was signed on as a privateer who had a unique sort of double letter of marque from the government during King William's War. On the one hand, the government wanted to vanquish the pirates in the Indian Ocean. So William Kidd was directed to go to the Indian Ocean and overpower pirates. But he was also given permission to attack French ships because at the time England was at war with France. So he went off expecting to be a privateer, but he wasn't having much success getting anybody. And finally, his men, many of whom were pirates who he had recruited, who initiated his men or him, but they ultimately descended into relatively small-scale piracy. They did attack a couple of ships that had French passes, so they appeared to be French ships, but they actually weren't French ships. And it's a fascinating career he had. He wasn't very successful in either endeavors, attacking French ships or being a pirate, but he was ultimately tried and hung in London. And that's why I call him a small-scale pirate who has had an outsized reputation ever since. And there have been plenty of books written about Captain Kidd that argue passionately that he wasn't a pirate, and those that argue passionately that he was a pirate. But I think a dispassionate look at the actual historical evidence would lead most people to conclude that he was a pirate, but not a very good one at that.
Yeah. A pirate people have heard of, especially around here, is Sam Bellamy. the Widow was a slave ship taken by Sam Bellamy. It sank off the coast of Cape Cod, as we know, and the wreck and treasure found not that long ago. The story of the Widow almost made for a Hollywood story, isn't it? So give us a little synopsis of what happened with Sam Bellamy and the Widow.
Well, Sam Bellamy and Palsgrave Williams, a guy from Rhode Island, went down to sort of dive on the Spanish treasure wrecks in 1715. That didn't work out so well. They veered into piracy. They slowly developed a small armada or fleet of pirates, and then they came upon the Widow, which had just sold 500 slaves in Port Royal. And as a result, their hold was full of bags of silver and gold. And Bellamy and his men overpowered the Widow, and they sailed north. They were ultimately going to Maine to careen their ships, but on the way they attacked a number of other ships and had some other victories. But then when they were off Cape Cod, a nor'easter blew down the coast and sent the Widow ashore, mm-hmm. right near Wellfleet. And somewhere around 161 pirates, the exact number is not known, perished. And all the treasure sank to the bottom. Two of the pirates made it to shore. And there the treasure sat for 267 years, I think it was, until Barry Clifford, a salvager and diver, found it. And he used a map that was created back in the 1720s by Cyprian Southack, one of the people that the governor sent out to try to retrieve the treasure at the time. And he used that, plus a lot of other historical data, to figure out where the wreck was. And what proved conclusively that they had the Widow is when they brought to the surface the Widow's Bell. Mm. And it says the Galley Widow on it. And as most of your listeners probably know, there's a wonderful museum out in West Yarmouth, the Widow the Pirate Museum, which recounts the story with relish.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, too, because when ships wrecked, that was everybody in town wanted to get down there and see what they could salvage, right?
Oh, Cape Codders. Now, take pride in this. Cape Codders were known as moon cussers. They cussed when the moon came out because on dark nights, it was more likely for ships to unintentionally veer into shoal waters and sink. And the thing is, when a ship sank near shore, then the people on shore, if they got there fast enough, they could pick up whatever was left over. And that could be things as mundane as wood from the ship or clothes. But if it's a pirate ship, there's the possibility of treasure. And in the days after the Widow crashed, the beach near where the crash occurred was alive with activity. Like vultures descending on a carcass, they came from all over the outer arm of the Cape to try to get their piece of the treasure. And even when the governor demanded that they turn over all the pieces of eight and gold or anything of value they might have collected.
We didn't collect anything.
We did. It's ours. It was manna from heaven. Yeah. We're going to take it, and it's going to be for our posterity, not for the government. Yeah.
And of course, there's the story of Sam Bellamy and Mary Hallett and their romance, which, again, you could find no evidence of, right?
I found no evidence. It's a wonderful story. I mean, the reason that myths or legends are so persistent is because they pull on our heartstrings or they're very dramatic. There was apparently a woman named Marie Hallett at the time who lived in East Ham, but there's no evidence that I was able to find, nor other pirate researchers were able to find, that showed a relationship between Bellamy and Maria Hallett. And from testimony taken contemporarily of other pirates who were on board the Widow at one time, they said that Bellamy's goal was not to go to East Ham or Wellfleet at the time. It was to go beyond the Cape and careen their ships in Maine. So I would be happy if somebody could find conclusive evidence that this assignation is the reason that he was heading towards the Cape and that he just got caught, unfortunately, by a nor'easter and crashed. But I found nothing to that effect, so I will not credit the story as being true.
All right.
But you still can tell it.
Yeah, you can still tell it. Yeah, it's a legend, right? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. Listening to The Point, we are talking with Eric J. Dolan about his new book, Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We talked a little bit earlier about getting people to join the cruise, and you know there was all that money incentive. But you also, it's just a really quick little thing in the book. You have a story about a 10-year-old boy named John King, who expressed interest in becoming a pirate. Even said he would kill his mom. Like, what's that?
Yeah, that's part of the Bellamy story. When they overtook a merchant ship down the Caribbean called the Bonetta, John King was on the ship being transported along with his mother, and perhaps he had heard great tales about pirate adventure. And when the pirates were looking for recruits, they took some, and they forced some men. However, John King wanted to go with the pirates, and his mother pleaded with him not to go. And instead of being a dutiful son, he turned around and threatened her, and they took him along.
Wow. All right. So we talked a little bit about Blackbeard, and Blackbeard has this reputation of being one of the most notorious pirates. But he wasn't any more cruel or inhumane than the rest, right? So how did he get that reputation of being, you know, this really?
How did he get the reputation? It's a good question. Exactly when it evolved, I think it was when Charles Johnson wrote The History of Pirates in the early to mid 1700s. He described Blackbeard is this literal devil coming out of the sea with burning matches under his hat as he went into battle. And it was an image that was larger than life, and certainly larger than Blackbeard was in life, because all the evidence we have about Blackbeard is that there are only two occasions on which he used violence. One is when his men took over his ship and they whipped a number of people on board to get them to divulge where the treasure was. And the other time that he was quite violent was in the battle off Ocracoke Island that ended his life when the naval forces came to take him in as an outlaw. But Blackbeard, like almost every other good pirate, wanted to win by intimidation, not by fighting, because if you could overpower your opponent without having to lose any blood, that was great. Also, you didn't want to damage the ship that you were taking over in case you wanted to move up and use that ship as one of yours. And you didn't want to potentially damage the cargo that was on board. So that's the whole reason why the Jolly Roger, the Black Flag, came about. It was a way of advertising, one, that you were a pirate, and two, that if you didn't surrender quickly, there was going to be trouble. And because every now and then, pirates did kill people, did get into vicious battles, they were able to maintain their threatening brand identity.
Yeah. And you weren't sure, is this one that's going to kill me or not?
And if you're a merchant on a ship, and you're a captain of a merchant ship, you don't own the ship probably, and you're working on the ship, are you going to give up your life to defend some cargo when you're getting paid a salary? Not.
Yeah. All right. So women typically didn't go to sea unless they were accompanying their husbands. There were some female American pirates, Anne Bonny and Rachel Wall. They haven't gotten as much attention as their male counterparts.
Well, but there's a good reason for that. There are very, very few female pirates. And the only two that I talk about in the book are Anne Bonny and Mary Read. And they actually didn't operate off the American colonies, so they're not officially in the purview of the book. But if you look through the historical record, even though they fought alongside Jack Rackham, and Anne Bonny was Jack Rackham, Captain Jack Rackham's, Calico Jack Rackham's lover, the testimony in the trial where they ultimately Jack Rackham was hanged, there's only a page or two about these two women, and there's very little other information about them. And the other pirate you mentioned, there are maybe a total of four women in the early 1700s that were either on a pirate ship and actively participated in piratical acts, or were just on a pirate ship because their husband was the captain of the pirate ship, and it's not at all clear that they did any of the pirating. So it's a minor story in the history of piracy, but it's a major story in people's imagination. And despite the fact that there's such thin evidence about what Anne Bonnie and Mary Read actually did. There are entire books written about those two. And people just eat them up because it's a great story.
Yeah. So how long did it take you to do the research for this book?
Each one of my books takes anywhere between 18 months and 2 years to research and write. And I would say the researching, for the first 8 months or so, all I do is read and take notes. But then I start writing the book. But once you start writing a book, you discover things that you either forgot to
look up.
So you go back and it's an iterative process. So research never really stops, but the bulk of the research is front-loaded for me. And then I have these files, computer files, full of tons of information that I have to synthesize and boil down into chapters that work and flow one into the other. So it's altogether, it's about a two-year process. And it's what's really fun is that I think I've mentioned this before other times I've been here. When I take on a book, it's almost always about a topic I know nothing about. Mm-hmm. And you may think that's because I don't know much about anything, but it's more because I want to stay interested in what I'm working on.
Right.
And if I pick a topic that I don't know a lot about, I'm guaranteed to have surprises along the way. And hopefully the excitement that I feel gets translated to some extent onto the page. But it's a grueling process, and there is nothing better than that day when you finish the manuscript. It just feels great. But then there's the editing process, and it just keeps going.
Yeah. So, and there are some surprises in the book. Like I say, some of the myths, you know, the pirates never said arg.
Yeah.
And, you know,
or not walking the plank.
Yeah, no, and also not burying the treasure. So what would you say was the biggest surprise that you uncovered? What surprised you the most when you were doing this book?
It's something that we already talked about, and it takes up a large part of the book, but it really shocked me, and that was the role that pirates played in American history in the late 1600s when they were part and parcel of the colonial fabric and had a major influence on the American experience at the time. I mean, I also liked writing about Blackbeard and Stede Bonnet and the pirates in the 17-teens, and especially like Edward Low, the sadistic Edward Low, who liked to slice people's noses and cut off their ears and boil their ears or roast them over a fire and force the victim to eat his own flesh. I mean, I loved all the dramatic stories, the gory stories, but in terms of what was most surprising to me as an historian, was this large swath of time in colonial history where pirates were an integral part of the story. And I knew nothing about that before I started in the book.
Yeah, me either. I was surprised about that as well. The other thing I thought was interesting, you know, we're talking about how, you know, evil, mean, whatever, vicious some of these pirates were. Yet there were times when they left somebody behind. They left him with a gun, some powder, and a shot.
Yes, pirates did on occasion maroon other pirates, whether they either broke the code or they were asking for too much or they were being annoying in some other way. There were pirates that were marooned, and if the people leaving them behind were nice, they would leave them with some food and hopefully some drink and maybe a gun. It's sort of like one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movie. I remember Johnny Depp and Keira Knightley are marooned on a very, very small island. That did happen. It didn't happen, you know, very many times. I didn't read about it happening many times, but it did happen. There was one pirate, John Quelch, who left from my hometown of Marblehead. They killed the captain, they mutinied, and they went down to Brazil to take over a bunch of ships. But while they were down there, one of the ships they took over, a man from Denmark decided to join the pirate crew. But then he demanded an equal share of the loot as all the other pirates who had already been working on the ship for many months did. And the other pirates said, forget it. We're not going to give you an equal cut. And they marooned him on the coast of Brazil.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that how democratic it is. They vote on things. They vote who's the captain. It was equal. And that's not our impression of a pirate ship. And our impression is the captain kind of rules all and makes all the rules and everybody else follows. And that's not exactly how it happened.
No, the pirate captain was captain at the leave of his men. And he could be voted out of office. And there are a number of cases in the book where I talk about pirates who were quote-unquote deposed, some violently, others not. But that makes sense. These pirates were out there. They were a floating society, often shunned by the rest of society, on the run, and they had to create rules to live by. Many of them mutinied and didn't like the treatment that merchant captains or naval captains had subjected them to. So they didn't want to be under the thumb of an all-powerful captain again. Mm-hmm. So they created a system in which there was relative equality. There was democracy of a sort, but it was democracy that was practical. You shouldn't make the mistake that them implying democratic principles somehow made them political philosophers or the antecedents of what spurred the American Revolution more than 100 years, you know, decades later. They were not doing it because they believed that democracy was the best way to determine the way in which men behaved. They did it because they needed a system that kept relative peace mm-hmm. on board the ship. Yeah. And the Pirates Code did that.
I'm thinking of when Blackbeard relieves Bonnet of his duty. And you know, he was recuperating, right, from his injuries. And he had put, when Bonnet was captain, he had put all these books. I mean, it was very, as you said, this gentleman who had a very probably different captain's quarters than anybody else, but Blackbeard let him keep it. He says, you know what, you can stay in the captain's quarters, you can keep your books.
Well, when Stede Bonnet built the ship, he put in bookcases in the captain's cabin so he could bring along his personal library, and some of the people that he and Blackbeard overtook, some of the ships, reported later in the local press that they saw this guy, Major Stede Bonnet, walking around the deck in his nightgown reading his books while he recuperated from his injuries.
That's funny. And the other funny thing about him is his first trip there, where he said, call me Captain Edwards. Like people weren't going to know who he was. And the first ship, he goes, I know who that captain was.
Yeah.
So in the past two decades, there was a rise in the number of piracy incidents off the east coast of Africa in the waters around Malaysia and Indonesia. Are the parallels between the modern-day pirates, are there parallels between those and what you write about?
Yeah, not just that. Many of your listeners probably have read stories in the last couple of months about a rise in piracy off the Venezuelan coast. And there are some parallels. One of them is clearly economic. A lot of the pirates that went into it during the Golden Age were hoping to strike it rich. Many of them were relatively poor sailors. And they viewed this as an economic opportunity. They were sort of like gamblers going into a casino thinking they were going to walk out with their pockets full of loot. Most of them failed to do that and had short, miserable lives that often ended in death. But that still didn't overcome their dreams that sort of propelled them into that line of work. The pirates off Somalia and off Venezuela, many of them are economically motivated because their countries are in severe distress, and they view piracy as a way to perhaps help themselves and help their families. Now, so there is a parallel there. There's also another unfortunate parallel, is that pirates of the Golden Age were often murderers and treated their victims poorly. And Somali pirates and the pirates off Venezuela have killed people and have been rather vicious in many of their attempts to take over ships. So there are those two parallels that I see. Mm-hmm. But there are also deeper reasons and other geopolitical reasons as to why piracy has exploded off the African coast and now in Venezuela that aren't 100% parallel to what happened in the late 1600s and the early 1700s.
You have a whole bunch of talks coming up. You have talks coming up in Falmouth, Oak Bluffs, and on Nantucket in the coming weeks. And we're going to put a link with more information about the book and a list of all your upcoming talks at our website, capeandislands.org. The book is Black Flags, Blue Waters, The Epic History of America's Most Notorious Pirates. Eric J. Dolan, always good to see you. Thanks for coming in and sharing your book with us.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.